Magic mirror in my hand. Who is the fairest in the land? I wonder how many of you, like the evil queen in Snow White, were fascinated by your reflection, and maybe still are. As a kid, I certainly was. I would linger in front of shiny surfaces, study how my image was warped in spoons, and I'd spend way too long in front of the bathroom mirror, much to the annoyance of my three younger siblings. I was once even scolded by my best friend when I was 8 for spending too long in front of her floor-length bathroom mirror. She got mad that my attention was on her, was on my reflection, and not on her and our shared game. I wasn't a particularly vain kid, and I don't think I'm alone in this preoccupation with my own image. But why are we amazed by our reflections? What are we looking for when we stare into mirrors? What is the magic that seems to hold us spellbound when we catch a glimpse of ourselves? Mirrors have always held some kind of magic for us. They've impacted our art, our stories, our technology, and have helped shape our very selves. According to neuroscientists, the ability to recognize images of ourselves is a form of self-awareness. Seeing ourselves in the bathroom mirror every day and saying, "Oh yeah, there I am," that's an act of self-awareness, thinking about ourselves. This simple act is an incredibly important leap in brain development, which separates us from other animals. And we can see this development happen in infants. My husband Cameron and I have been fortunate to see this process up close with our niece Juniper, who was born this summer. And this should be her in August, being held by her dad. Juniper loves the mirror and the other baby that she sees in it. But like a budgie, she has no idea that she's seeing a reflection of herself. Yet there's a shift that happens as children near the age of 2. Suddenly, they become aware of themselves. Infant researchers study this phenomenon by placing paint on a child's face without them noticing. A child younger than 18 months would point to the spot on the mirror as though to wipe away the spot on the other baby. After 18 months, they would point to their own face, recognizing that the image they saw was somehow connected to themselves. So by the time we turn 2, with the dawning of our self-awareness, we begin a journey of developing our own identity. Arguably, this becomes the primary task of our lives. But this wasn't always the case. In fact, for most of our history, humans have thought very little about their individual identities. We can connect this back to the mirror again. Before the 14th century, mirrors were made of bronze or other metals. They weren't very effective, and they were very expensive. Most people had no access to a reliable mirror, and therefore had no idea what they looked like. And most people probably didn't care anyway. If you were a peasant in rural England in the 1300s, you were probably more concerned with getting your crops in on time than worrying about what you looked like or whether you were living up to your potential as an individual. It wasn't until the creation of the glass, silver-backed mirror that we started to think about ourselves in more individualistic ways. Art became more realistic, and artists even began painting themselves. And rich people also started paying artists to show them as they wanted to be, to communicate their power, status, and goodness visually. Today, most of us don't pay other people to alter our image. We do it ourselves with Photoshop, apps, and Instagram filters. But why do we do this? Why have humans done this throughout history? I think one reason is because we long for others to affirm us in our identities, to validate our existence. We're plagued by the question, if we aren't seen by others, do we really exist? To me, this existential question, our current technology, and our global connectedness create a perfect storm which has given us the culture of the selfie. Because today, we aren't just looking to family members and peers to validate our identity. We're turning to online communities, to Facebook friends, Instagram followers, YouTube and blog subscribers, all of them to affirm us in who we are. And I love how the theologian Craig Detweiler puts it in his book, Selfies, Searching for the Image of God in a Digital Age. He says, "To me, so much of the crisis in our country and culture is rooted in issues of identity. People are feeling unseen, unacknowledged, and underrepresented, and they're desperately crying out to be noticed, affirmed, and loved. I see selfies as rooted in our deepest hunger, our greatest longing." What is this deepest hunger, this greatest longing, which Detweiler is referring to? What are we looking for? To provide an answer, we can turn to the greatest work of fiction of all time, Harry Potter. In the first book, our orphaned hero Harry stumbles upon the mirror of Erised, a mirror which shows a person's greatest desire. When he looks into it, he sees himself surrounded by the family he has never known. He sees that he belongs and that he is loved. Isn't that what we're looking for too? When we peer into our bathroom mirrors or post selfies online, we too are seeking the validation that we matter and that we belong. And as we grow up, we move from recognizing ourselves in a mirror to looking to others to affirm and to love us. We try to capture our identity through selfies and other self-expressions, show them to the world, and we desperately hope that others will say, "Oh yeah, there you are." But can we always trust others to be a mirror for us, telling us who we are? Even Jesus, who obviously lived long before our smartphone-driven age, shows us the challenge of giving other people the power to define your identity. He asked his disciples, "Who do people say that I am?" And he gets all kinds of answers. Elijah, one of the prophets, John the Baptist. The disciples seem to be too polite to mention the people who think Jesus is a lunatic or a demon. In fact, throughout Jesus' life, we have people questioning his identity. And yet when Peter seems to give the right answer, saying, "You are the Messiah, the Son of the living God," Jesus has a couple of very odd responses. In Matthew's gospel, he praised Peter, but then he sternly ordered the disciples not to tell anyone that he was the Messiah. From that time on, Jesus began to show his disciples that he must go to Jerusalem and undergo great suffering at the hands of the elders, the chief priests, and scribes, and be killed and on the third day be raised. It's as though Peter and the disciples have gotten a glimpse of who Jesus really is. His glory, his amazingly true selfie as the Son of God. And yet Jesus is saying, "Yeah, but I don't want you to post that. In fact, I want you to keep quiet about who I am, because there is going to be trouble, and I don't think you can handle it." So here, we're seeing that Jesus has a fuller and deeper understanding of who he is and what his mission is. And he doesn't seem to share our human need to be publicly affirmed in his identity. We see this clearly when Jesus is being tempted by the devil. We read in Matthew's gospel that Jesus is led by the Spirit into the wilderness, where he fasts for 40 days and 40 nights, and is joined by the devil, who encourages Jesus to show off his identity as the Son of God. The devil proposes all kinds of stunts that have true trending potential. He wants Jesus to turn stones into bread, to throw himself off the highest pinnacle of the city so that angels will save him, and to worship him, the devil, so that he will give Jesus all of the kingdoms of the world. I imagine this scenario as the devil, poised with his cell phone, saying to Jesus, "Come on, just one video. Show me who you really are. Let's show the world." The devil is trying to get Jesus to go on a mad selfie blitz to show that he is favored by God. But Jesus doesn't budge. He never feels the need to prove himself to the tempter, and he never wavers in his path or in his self-understanding. Where did this conviction come from? I think it comes, in large part, from what happens just before Jesus goes into the wilderness. Directly before this, Jesus is baptized by John. And here's the passage from Matthew. When Jesus had been baptized, just as he came up out from the water, suddenly the heavens were opened to him, and he saw the Spirit of God descending like a dove and alighting on him. And a voice from heaven said, "This is my Son, the Beloved, with whom I am well pleased." Imagine having an episode like that in your life, basically akin to Beyoncé liking one of your Instagram posts. If I had a dove alight on me and a voice from heaven boom that I am beloved, I wouldn't doubt my identity either. But what if we do all have these experiences? Not in the dramatic way Jesus did, but in smaller, simpler ways. Henry Nouwen was a spiritual writer, and he argues that each of us are the beloved of God, that this is our true identity. In his book, Life of the Beloved, he says that the words we hear spoken to Jesus at his baptism actually apply to all of us, no matter our tradition. He says that we all have a voice within that speaks from the depth of our being, telling us who we really are. And he says of this voice, "I have called you by name from the beginning. You are mine and I am yours. You are my beloved, on you my favor rests. I have molded you in the depths of the earth and knitted you together in your mother's womb. I have carved you in the palms of my hands and hidden you in the shadow of my embrace. You belong to me. Wherever you are, I will be. Nothing will ever separate us. We are one." This is a description of an immensely intimate relationship between God and each one of us. And this is such an important idea in the Christian tradition that we even have a short form for it, Imago Dei, or that we are made in the image of God. For a great explanation of this, Pope John Paul II wrote in one of his letters to the Christian community, "The life which God gives us is quite different from the life of all other living creatures. Inasmuch as we, although formed from the dust of the earth, are a manifestation of God in the world, a sign of his presence, a trace of his glory. Humans have been given a sublime dignity based on the intimate bond which unites us to our Creator. In us there shines forth a reflection of God himself." In us there shines forth a reflection of God himself. When we see ourselves in a mirror, we are really seeing a reflection of God. And this may seem a little bit beyond us, especially on the days when our hair is all over the place and our face has creases from our pillow. But it is actually simpler than it sounds. After all, we see the same illustration in The Lion King, when Simba looks into the pool at Rafiki's bidding, searching for his father. It's pretty deep for a Disney movie. And while we can't say that we are the true kings of Pride Rock, we too are called to remember that we have a special identity, that we hold this image of God, and that we are beloved. Not only that, but we share this identity with the rest of humanity too. You could say that we are each a different selfie of God, a slightly different look or filter, but each giving a peek at who God really is. But affirming this belovedness, this image of God in ourselves and in other people, that's incredibly hard to do. Henry Nouwen even acknowledges the challenge in our world today of recognizing our identity. Here he's talking about that inner voice again. "That voice has always been there, but it seems that I was much more eager to listen to other, louder voices saying, 'Prove that you are worth something. Do something relevant, spectacular, or powerful, and then you will earn the love you so desire.' Meanwhile, the soft, gentle voice that speaks into the silence and solitude of my heart remained unheard or at least unconvincing. Aside from missing the gentle voice which speaks into the solitude of our hearts, Craig Detweiler argues that there are also major consequences socially if we don't recognize ourselves as God's beloved. He says, if we don't understand that we are self-images of God, and we can't see the self-image of God in our neighbor, then we will definitely attack, deride, and degrade each other. So we can agree that it's essential to affirm this identity of belovedness in ourselves and in each other. But how? Henry Nouwen offers a few different suggestions. One is to unmask the world's messages for what they really are, lies about ourselves. Of course, this is much easier said than done. Perhaps one way is to attempt this is to prioritize the small voice within us, which tells us the truth, rather than the voices outside of us, and especially those on social media. The second suggestion Nouwen gives is to offer gratitude for our belovedness, our chosenness, however it might show up in our lives. Choosing to give thanks rather than to give in to bitterness or doubt, that's a way to affirm ourselves as a divine choice, a beloved child. And finally, we should search out people who remind us of this deepest identity. We need entire communities of Rafikis in our lives to remind us to look more closely, to see God in our own reflections. And we need constant reminders to see God's image in our family members, our friends, strangers, and our enemies. Which brings us, in a roundabout way, back to baptism. I've grown up in the Catholic tradition, and for me, baptism is a sacrament, a ritual that affirms your identity as a beloved child of God. It's an official welcome into a community which tries to walk this path of faith together. I once heard a speaker who, instead of talking about baptism as a once-in-your-life-time event, described it as what should be a daily soaking in God's love, in the affirmation of your true identity as God's beloved. He also argued that we should be doing this for each other every day, that we need to be baptizing each other on a regular basis, that we should essentially be holding up a divine mirror to one another, saying, remember, this is you. You are a beloved child of God. That is who you really are. And that can seem like a big responsibility. And on the one hand, it is. But it doesn't need to be burdensome. There are really practical ways that we can hold up that divine mirror to each other. One way is to reclaim the ancient practice of blessing. For most in our Western culture, blessing is limited to the response you give when someone around you sneezes. But the word blessing comes from the Latin root benedictio, which literally means to speak well of someone. Henry Nouwen says that to give a blessing is to say yes to someone's belovedness, words spoken from the heart which affirm their innate beauty and value. In his book, Henry Nouwen tells a beautiful story from his time living at L'Arche, a community of people with and without disabilities living together in a house in Richmond Hill. He describes a young woman with disabilities named Janet, who one day asked him for a blessing. As a Catholic priest, Nouwen was used to blessing people, and so he went right into it, with a cross marked on Janet's forehead with his thumb. But Janet wasn't satisfied. No, that doesn't work. I want a real blessing, she insisted. Taken aback, Henry agreed to give her a blessing after their prayer service. At the appointed time, when the community was gathered together, Henry called up Janet for her special blessing. And she came right up to him, put her arms around him with her head against his chest. And Nouwen wrapped his arms around her and said, Janet, I want you to know that you are God's beloved daughter. You are precious in God's eyes. Your beautiful smile, your kindness to people in your house, and all the good things that you do show us what a beautiful human being you are. I know you feel a little low these days and that there is some sadness in your heart, but I want you to remember who you are, a very special person, deeply loved by God and all the people who are here with you. Henry goes on to recount how, after Janet, many L'Arche community members came forward for their own blessings, both those with and without disabilities. I've read the book, Life of the Beloved, many, many times. Yet each time I come to this segment, I still get goosebumps. This scene of intimacy and authenticity speaks deeply to me, and I think to our global desire to be loved and blessed in this way. And if I look through my life, I can identify small and beautiful moments when I too have been blessed or have blessed other people. Every year on my birthday, I'm lucky to receive words of love and affirmation from family and friends who take the time to remind me that I matter to them. Sometimes the blessing comes in the form of a hug from a family member or time spent together in silence with a friend. When I worked as a university residence assistant, I would write inspirational quotes or short notes on the mirrors in our communal bathroom. For me, it was an act of acknowledgement that this was often a stressful time of life, and that the girls on my floor sometimes needed a reminder that they were beautiful and capable women who could persevere through the challenges of university. It wasn't until years later that I realized that this was my attempt to remind them of their identity as someone loved and cared for, to bless them. And some take this need for blessing to a very practical place. Pastors and priests of some Christian traditions do house blessings. They go throughout the house, blessing each room and the implements within them. As strange as it may seem, this blessing also extends to the bathroom. I don't know what a toilet blessing might look like, but I'm sure they've got one. Tish Harrison Warren describes this in her book, Liturgy of the Ordinary, and she says of the priest, "He anoints the bathroom mirror with oil and prays that when people look into it, they would see themselves as beloved images of God." And at the end of her book, she offers suggestions for spiritual practices, including, as you look at your face in the mirror, thank God for making and loving your body. I would challenge you as you leave today to consider a small, simple practice that you could begin to affirm your own belovedness and that of others. It might be writing a reminder on your mirror or making a point to tell someone else that they matter to you. Whatever you choose, I do strongly believe that if we all took the time each day to remind ourselves and others of who we really are, to soak each other in God's love, I think our world would be a kinder and healthier place. Mirrors are magical things, but they are also deceptive. We believe that when we look into them, that we're seeing our true selves, physically and spiritually. We fall into the trap that what the mirror shows us and what our society affirms in us is the fullness of our identity, but it's not. And if we aren't careful, we'll get caught staring into magic mirrors that show us only partial truths. Paul himself warns us of this in one of the most direct quotations in Scripture about mirrors. He says, "For we know only in part, and we prophesy only in part. But when the complete comes, the partial will come to an end. For now we see in a mirror, dimly, but then we will see face to face. Now I know only in part, then I will know fully, even as I have been fully known." Paul is reminding us that our perception and our understanding is only partial. We are looking into a mirror that is clouded. Our view of the world, and especially our view of ourselves, is flawed. It's flawed in comparison with the overwhelming knowledge and love of God, who fully knows us. And maybe this is the double lesson of the mirrors. They are hugely influential in our understandings of ourselves, but they can never show us the full picture. The truer, deeper understanding of our identity comes from God and needs to be reflected to us by those who know who we truly are, and vice versa. I'd now like to call up the band. And so instead of looking into our mirrors and asking, who is the fairest? Maybe we should be asking, who is God's beloved? I don't know that your mirror will answer you back, but I hope that you will listen to the answer from your community, from this community, and from the small voice within you. The answer to who is God's beloved is simple, and it is always the same. You are.